So I was saying a couple of days ago that in a way this is a wee bit of a change in what we've done in previous international council meetings. We're bringing in a much more explicit study element and practice element. I don't know what happens in the various meetings and groupings that you're involved in, but in the Preceptors College we always have a study element as part of the session, and we tend to do it quite early in the meeting. And my own experience is that just creating that shared spiritual ground and having people connect on that ground, having people connect to their own Dharma practice, it informs, I'm reluctant to say the business, but it means the practical things that we do are more likely to be informed by that sort of deeper flavour. So we were quite interested to try to bring this a bit more explicitly into this meeting and just get a sense of how it worked. So we're looking at quite a simple text. It's a simple text, it's a profound text, but it's a text called The Eight Verses for Training the Mind. The text itself, well, maybe I could start off by reading it, actually, just so you get a little bit of a sense of it. Then I'll say a bit about the text. So the text reads, "May I cherish, always cherish all beings with the resolve to accomplish for them the highest good that's more precious than any wish-fulfilling jewel. Whenever I'm in the company of others, may I regard myself as inferior to all, and from the depths of my heart, cherish others as supreme. In all my actions, may I watch my mind, and as soon as disturbing emotions arise, may I firmly face them at once, since they will hurt both me and others. When I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by wrong deeds and pain, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove. When someone out of envy does me wrong by insulting me and the like, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them. Even if someone whom I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes does great wrong in harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. In brief, directly or indirectly, may I give help and joy to my mothers, and may I take all their harm and pain secretly upon myself. May none of this ever be sullied by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I see all things as illusions, and without attachment, gain freedom from bondage." So that's the text. Maybe I could ask, first of all, how many people aren't really familiar with this text?
Are not familiar?
Okay, so a minority. It's becoming probably quite a well-known text within Sri Ratna. I think a few years ago you could say it was less well-known than a slightly later text, the seven-point mind training, which is much longer than the eight-point mind training. But the Dalai Lama especially has been doing a lot of teaching around the eight-point mind training, and it's one of the texts that have definitely been sort of taken up more and more within Sri Ratna. It was one of the things we discussed in the Preceptors College, actually. There was obviously a lot of interest in the mind training tradition and the mind training verses. And we had a conversation with Bhante about the texts. And he was interesting. He was saying that he himself had been aware that there was quite a lot of interest, and that towards the end of his time in Majjhima Loka, he had started to do study groups around some of the mind training verses, which was news to most of us, but sort of had a little quiet study group going around the mind training verses, and he was encouraging us to look at them in a little bit more depth. So we thought it would be interesting just to bring the eight verses for training the mind here. This particular text, it's quite an early text in what's called the Lojong tradition in Tibet, which just means the mind training tradition. It's a text by a teacher called Langri Tangpa, who's a disciple of a disciple of a Tisha. And the Lojong tradition, it traces its roots back to earlier Indian texts, earlier Indian sources like Bodhicharya Avatara by Shantideva, even Precious Garland by Nagarjuna. But it probably starts to take its more characteristic form of very pithy aphorisms in Atisha's teaching, and in a way Atisha's the start of this Lojong tradition. Atisha's an Indian teacher who moved to Tibet in the mid-11th century, and as I say, Langri Tangpa, I think, is teaching early to mid-12th century, and he's a disciple of a disciple of Atisha. I'll try and give you a little bit more context, but we studied this in the Preceptors' College with Subhuti, and one of the bits that I found a bit esoteric when we were doing the study was Subhuti trying to explain one of the traditional explanations of Atisha's position. And apparently Atisha brought three different Indian traditions to Tibet and sort of synthesized them in his own teaching. He brought what was called the lineage of the profound view, which was mainly a Majjhimaka tradition emphasizing wisdom. He brought what was called the lineage of extensive action, which was basically a bodhicitta lineage of action for the benefit of all beings. And he brought a lineage called the lineage of profound practice, which is quite characteristic of Atisha's own teaching, where there's a lot of emphasis on direct experience and what you have to do directly in practice to give body to your deeper understanding. So, as I say, that bit for me was a wee bit esoteric, but it was interesting what came out in the study, and the idea that in all of these Lojong texts, you've got these three elements. There's always an underlying view, and the underlying view is that the Majjhimaka view of emptiness, of shunyata. So that's there explicitly, characteristically, in these Lojong teachings. What Subhuti was saying is to have a complete practice, these three elements need to be there and need to be active. So this deepening clarity of view needs to be there. There needs to be an idea of an aspiration almost of how we want to act coming out of that view. So in the Lojong tradition, it's this emphasis on bodhicitta, acting for the emphasis for the benefit of all beings. And then this idea of practice is what fills the gap. So you've got this vision of what's possible. You've got this idea of what you want your action to be like. So the practice becomes, what do you have to do to turn vision into effective transformation? How do you close the gap between what you see as possible and what our behaviour actually is? So these Lojong texts have this explicit wisdom element. You've got this glimpse of the nature of reality at whatever level that starts to inform our sense of the nature of things, of what's possible. You've got an aspiration of how that wants to be expressed. And then your practice is, what do you have to do to start to close that gap? That's the practice. Just in my own sort of thinking, I kept on trying to move this away from what started off for me as a slightly esoteric idea of lineages, trying to kind of chunk it down into behaviours. Actually, the text itself does a lot of that. But I was thinking there was an overlap for me between this idea of the view, the action, and the practice, and what Bante talks about in the five great stages. So that the five great stages is really the source text for our own way of thinking about the whole system of practice. But that three of the five great stages, like Bante says, you've got to be doing five things every day. The first one is that you just keep up the effort to be mindful of your own mental states, which has an explicit parallel in this text. Yeah, so the five great stages, that the first two, I'm going to just very quickly, stay mindful, stay emotionally positive. But the third one, for me, sort of links to this idea of view. And what Bante says is, every day, one of the things that we're consciously trying to do is not lose sight of what the ultimate goal is, or not lose sight of what's most deeply important in our practice. And I think the idea of that as a conscious daily reflection has a bit of a link with this idea of the view. The next of the five great stages is trying to apply at every level what you've discovered at the deepest level of your own practice. So what you've felt in your own deep practice, how does that get expressed? How does that get lived out in our action? Nobody waving, good. And the third of them is this lovely little summing up of the five great stages, which is you do your best for other people and do what you can to help people. And for me, that idea of you don't lose sight of what's deeply important, you're trying to act from what's deeply important in a consistent way, and you're doing it in a context that includes yourself and others, has an overlap with this idea of underlying view, action, and the practice that links those two. So I found that link helpful. Very, very quickly, just looking at the structure of the text, when we were divvying this up, there seemed to be a number of kind of natural breaks in the text. So the first two verses are basically bringing in this perspective of self and other. And it's basically saying that your practice, any move away from self, the reflex of that is a move that includes other more naturally. So a lovely line from Shantideva that I think links anatta and bodhicitta. Shantideva says, my mind seeks nirvana. Nirvana is the letting go of all. If I must let go of all, it is best that it is given to beings. And I think in these first two verses, you've got that flavour. There's a move away from self-clinging, and the reflex of that is a more responsiveness to self and other. I'm doing it from memory, but roughly, Shantideva is saying, nirvana is the letting go of all. My mind seeks nirvana. If I must let go of all things, it is best that they are given to beings, best that it is given to beings. And for me, that's just that lovely connection between letting go of self and this coming into a different quality of awareness of self and other. So you get that in the first two verses. Third verse is just starting to look at your own self-awareness. And particularly, there's a mindfulness that's aware of any disturbance to that openness. So whenever something comes up that gets in the way of that intention to be open to self and other, you, as the text says, firmly face it and at once and sort of act to create something more open. Then you've got this lovely little group of 4, 5, and 6, which Ratnadarni will go into in more detail. But it's looking at kinds of relationship in particular that are most likely to create egocentric reaction. And it gradually just raises the bar. So the first one is when you see ill-natured people, cherish them. Second one is when somebody out of envy does you wrong, accept defeat and offer victory to them. And the third one is even if somebody who we've helped does great wrong in harming us, regard them as an excellent spiritual friend. So each of those is just starting to look at triggers that bring about egocentric reactions and just reflecting on how do we respond in a way that's more skillful, that acts out of these deep values. Verse 7 is starting to move into meditation practice. So you're giving help and joy to your mothers and taking harm and pain secretly onto yourself. And giving and taking is explicitly a reference to Tonglen practice. Tonglen just means giving and receiving, giving and taking. So verse 7 moves you into meditation practice. And specifically, Tonglen is the core of our own bodhicitta practice. So you're looking at bodhicitta practice and how bodhicitta practice as a sitting practice supports these verses. Just to go back to the earlier verses for a minute, one of the lovely ideas in the whole Lojong tradition coming from the seven-point mind training is this idea that you take adversity onto the path. And what you've got with the Lojong practices, again, this idea of you train with slogans. It's something that you've remembered deeply enough so that a difficult situation becomes the reminder to move to awareness. So whenever disturbing emotions arise, the only thing that you've got to remember is to firmly face them and respond to them at once. Whenever somebody out of envy does you wrong, that's the trigger to think, what am I supposed to be doing here again? How do I respond to this in a way that doesn't move to that sort of egocentricity? So to have something this succinct and something that makes difficult situations themselves the reminder of what that process of practice, what that process of transformation looks like, that's the instruction here. So verse 7 moves on to meditation. And verse 8, in a way, sort of brings in this deeper wisdom ground. So in verse 8, you bring in this reflection of seeing all things as illusions and without attachment gaining freedom from bondage. Viveka is going to touch on that verse. So very simple, non-discursive texts, but it starts off very concrete, moves more and more deeply through our habitual reactions into this absolutely open, unattached experience of wisdom. So that's the text. Just spend a little time. Today we're going to look at the first verse. It'll be interesting to see what people can do with this in the study groups, because I say it's not a very discursive text, so let's see if we can find a way in. Shall I pause for breath for a moment? Okay. It's amazing, isn't it, how you can talk without breathing? It's like the same as the bagpipes, Scottish bagpipes. You have to suck and blow at the same time. I see. There's a drone that helps. Anyway. Great, thank you, Viveka. Okay, so the text that the verse that we're going to start with today is this first one of "May I cherish all beings with the resolve to accomplish for them the highest good that's more precious than any wish-fulfilling jewel." So, a few things to say around that. Start off with this idea of cherishing. And the commentary on this, the study that we did on this, I found very interesting. So I believe the original language of this talks about self-cherishing, the underlying idea is that there's a hardwired attitude of self-cherishing. And self-cherishing is one of what's called the Atma Kleshas. And the Atma Kleshas are just hardwired ways that we misperceive experience and misconstrue experience. So the Pali word for this is Atma Sneha. So the kind of underlying idea in the Yogacara tradition, I think, is that everybody has this fundamental, hardwired cherishing of their own well-being, however a distorted way it expresses itself, this self-cherishing is there. And what we're being asked to do in this practice is not get rid of the self-cherishing, but gradually, with the very same structure that you get in metta bhavana, you're moving that natural self-cherishing out to include others. So it's the idea that we, again, you get this in bodhicitta practice. One of the basic reflections is, as we want to be happy, all beings want to be happy. As we want to be free of suffering, all beings want to be free of suffering. As we want to be happy but act in ways that cause ourselves pain, all beings want to be happy and act in ways that cause themselves pain. So in a sense, this idea of self-cherishing is that reflection starting to come into a relationship with other people. Just this awareness of other people's experience, this sense of this urge in us and in others towards happiness, towards liberation, and a natural responsiveness. How do we become aware of that? How do we respond to that in a way that supports it? So that's this idea of self-cherishing.
Can you explain what hardwired?
Hardwired just means it's part of a... It's just the natural way that conditioned consciousness structures experience. That might not be much clearer, but we tend to see things in terms of self and other, and especially self as important and other as less important. And one of the underlying ideas in all of this is this idea that self and other is a misperception of the nature of things. That actually, as you look more deeply into experience, there's no hard boundary, there's nothing fixed, there's nothing separate. And as you look more deeply into experience, surprise, surprise, it's not quite the way we thought it was. So what you're doing here is you're taking that maybe quite abstract idea to begin with, of a cognitive way of thinking about it, and kind of coming at it emotionally, coming at it behaviourally. Well, one of the things Bhante says in Living with Kindness is that it's a mistake to see insight in overly cognitive terms, and that quite often it's the move, that the emotional move into more awareness of other, that moves us away from that habitual self-reference. And that sometimes, he says, the understanding follows the emotional shift rather than the understanding preceding it. So what we're doing with self, this idea of cherishing all beings, is that we're starting to work against this fundamental gravity, this fundamental emotional habit of splitting experience into self and other. We're starting to attend to other people and starting to respond to them in a way that gives them equal importance, gives them equal weight. So that's the practice in this verse. And in doing that, we're working against fundamental kleshas. You're actually starting to work in a way, on an emotional level, on a behavioural level, at a fundamental insight experience, was what we were suggesting. So that's the first of the phrases, the first of the points to make around self-cherishing. The second point, that the resolve to accomplish for beings the highest good that's more precious than any wish-fulfilling jewel. And there's two ways that you can read this part of the text. One is that we want for beings their highest good. And the other one is that our highest good is served by responding to other beings. And again, you've got this idea that any fundamental spiritual practice is a move away from self into a different relationship between self and other. And in making that move, anything that supports us in making that move is addressing our own sort of deepest values, our own deepest needs. To come back to bodhicitta practice again, I love this little idea in bodhicitta practice that there's this fundamental drive towards happiness, towards enlightenment, towards liberation. But we misunderstand. All beings seek happiness and do the things that cause ourselves pain. So what we're starting to do in this verse is understand more deeply what it is that serves that deep drive in ourselves towards liberation, towards freedom. Starting to clarify that every action that comes out of aversion, comes out of craving, every action that polarizes us just traps us in a deeper and deeper sense of what it is that liberates us. And I don't want to get too fancy, but in a sense, just that same sense of as we wish to be happy, as we wish to be free, all beings wish to be happy. All beings wish to be free. And the main thing you've got in this part of the verse, I think, is just this awareness that starts to be alive to our own emerging life, starts to be alive to that same emerging life in others, and a kind of empathy. How do we respond to people in a way that supports that emerging? It's hard to talk about this without, well, for me, without being abstract, but how do we support that emerging current, that emerging process in people? NVC's gone out of fashion, but I remember I did a lot of NVC training at one point, and that the really significant thing in NVC for me wasn't the kind of methodology about, was it observations and needs and all the rest of it. It was just at one point realising that it was possible to pay attention to other people. And this might not come as a big shock to you, but for me it was a revelation, you know. Actually start to have a real curiosity about what mattered to them, about what was important to them, and just this idea of how do you come into relationship in a way that supports what it is that's trying to emerge in other people's experience. It was a real little moment of revelation, actually. And I think what this verse is getting at is how do we train in that kind of attention that just as well as that aliveness to our own needs, our own happiness, there's a broadening out of awareness into our responsiveness, sensitivity, just this natural, spontaneous wish to support what's emerging in others without being too kind of woo-woo about it, almost trusting that underneath any behaviour, there's this push for liberation if we can come into relationship with it skillfully enough, with enough awareness. So fundamentally, that's the text. That self-cherishing, broadening out the self-cherishing and realising that that move away from that self-reference into awareness of self and others serves our own deepest good, serves others' deepest good. The Dalai Lama was very nice and grounded about this. He says, basically, if you're only concerned about yourself, you're pretty uptight. And if people feel that you're interested in them, they tend to like you and you tend to be happy. Right, so that's the very grounded version of it. In the study, again, be interesting just to see what people make of this, but I was thinking sort of what I'd be interested in looking at in the study. Let me just find my own. I was saying it's not a very discursive text, that there's not a lot of unpacking that you have to do in terms of the ideas. The ideas are pretty direct. But I must say, one of the reflections that sparked off for me was around this thing about views. And, you know, like you'll hear this again and again in Sri Ratna, is the importance of underlying views. And you definitely get that in this text. The whole thing's grounded on this seeing all things as illusion and non-attachment. It's based on a Majjhimaka view. As you know, Nagarjuna links Shunyata to Paticca-samuppada, and Paticca-samuppada is the central doctrinal idea of Sri Ratna, you could say, of the whole Buddhist tradition. But I was just interested, how conscious am I of my own shaping views? I wonder how often I make my underlying view very conscious, how often it really does start to affect how I act. And I was talking about this with a few people over breakfast, and just somebody was saying that when you bring up the idea of views and ask people to articulate their own underlying views, you kind of freeze. It's not always easy to sum up what your view is. But one suggestion, I think Lokeshvara's suggestion, was if you had to come up with a slogan, if you had to come up with an aphorism that expressed what was most deeply significant, most deeply important in your practice, what would that aphorism be? How would you describe what's deepest in your own practice? And do you manage to stay in touch with that? What helps you stay in touch with that to the extent that it starts to be an influence in practice? And a second question I had, we were asked to link the study all the way through to the themes of the meeting itself. And one of the themes today is Kalyanamitrata. And you've got this very explicitly in this text, this idea of starting to cherish all beings and acting for their good. And I was thinking, you don't do that from a standing start. You don't go from self-cherishing to cherishing all beings. In terms of practice, in terms of gradual transformation, it happens in specific relationships. It happens in friendships. It happens in the close working relationships where we've really got emotional connections with people. I would say for most of us, that's where that process of transformation starts to happen. And a couple of questions I had. I've been realising, I was saying in my report and in the other day, that one of the things I've been a bit worried about is in some of the discussions of Sri Ratna issues, kind of movement-wide, I've been pretty narky. Some things have been going on that have seriously irritated me. Some of the discussions have totally wound me up, and I'm Scottish enough to express my irritation freely and easily. And I'm realising, actually, it is not going to help our movement if I'm acting out of unskillful mental states. I think that might be true. And a question I had is, if we take this idea of a shift into more responsive, more empathic awareness of others, how might that inform the way we work together? And in a way, it's not an abstract answer. Sorry? If we take this idea of more awareness, more empathy for others, how might that inform our working relationships with each other? If part of our responsibility is creating spiritual community, how do we do it? What does this verse suggest in terms of our working relationships with each other? And what does this verse suggest in terms of how our work, our collective work,
comes into relationship with the rest of the movement, what would that look like? What do we need to be doing? What would it look like? So there were at least a couple of things that the text sparked off for me. And please engage with this text in any way that you find stimulating or helpful. But there were a couple of questions that I thought some people might find interesting in the discussion.